Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, The Next Generation of Cephalosporins, New Additions in the Arsenal Against Complicated Skin and Skin Structure Infections. This CME activity is based on the slides and lectures presented by the faculty at the symposium entitled The Next Generation of Cephalosporins, New Additions in the Arsenal Against Complicated Skin and Skin Structure Infections, which was held on September 18, 2011, at the Palmer House Hilton, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright by CME Insight. This activity is certified by Penn State College of Medicine and Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and presented by Joseph S. Slomkin, M.D., Ronald N. Jones, M.D., Warren S. Joseph, D.P.M., FIDSA, and Vance G. Fowler, M.D., Dr. Fowler is an associate professor, Department of Medicine, Division of Infectious Diseases, Duke University Medical Center, Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Fowler has disclosed the following: grant and/or research support from Advanced Liquid Logic, Sorexa, National Institutes of Health, Merck, Novartis, Pfizer, and Theravance; advisor and/or consultant for Astellas, Biosynexis, Galderma, Inamex, Metamune, Novadime, Novartis, Pfizer, and The Medicines Company. Dr. Fowler also jointly held a patent for a rapid diagnostic approach for etiology and prognosis in sepsis. Dr. Jones is with JMI Laboratories, North Liberty, Iowa, Tufts University School of Medicine, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Jones has disclosed the following: JMI Laboratories has received research and educational grants in 2010 and 2011 from Achaogen, Ares, American Proficiency Institute, Anacor, Astellas, AstraZeneca, Bayer, bioMérieux, Sempra, Sorexa, Cosmo Technologies, Cubist, Daiichi, Enanta, Furiex, GlaxoSmithKline, Johnson & Johnson, LegoChem Biosciences, Meiji Seika Kaisha, Merck, Empex, Nobreva, Novartis, Paratech, Pfizer, PPD Therapeutics, Premier Research Group, Saccad, Shionogi, Shionogi USA, The Medicines Company, Theravance, Trek Diagnostics, and Vertex Pharmaceuticals, advisor and/or consultant for Astellas, Sempra, Sorexa Forest, Cubist, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, and Theravance. Dr. Joseph is with Roxborough Memorial Hospital, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Joseph has disclosed the following: Speakers Bureau and advisor and/or consultant for Merck and Pfizer. Dr. Slomkin is a professor of surgery, University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Cincinnati, Ohio. Dr. Slomkin has disclosed the following: advisor and/or consultant for Astellas, AstraZeneca, Ethicon Surgical, Merck, and Pfizer. Complicated skin and skin structure infections continue to pose significant clinical challenges and are responsible for increasing healthcare costs. CSSSIs are caused by an evolving variety of pathogens, including gram-positive, gram-negative, and anaerobic bacteria. Due to resistance patterns of common microorganisms, treatment can be challenging. Clinicians must recognize the early symptoms and signs of severe CSSSIs to ensure effective antibiotic therapy. The goal of this educational activity is to educate healthcare professionals on the appropriateness of antibiotic selection and administration based on resistance patterns and individual patient risk factors. This activity is supported by Forest Laboratories. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Joe Slomkin. I'm a surgeon and professor of surgery at the University of Cincinnati. And I'm going to be talking with you about the classification and treatment of complicated skin and skin structure infections. The ones that we're most concerned about, particularly as surgeons, are those that are deemed complicated. And these include infections that generally require some sort of either abscess drainage or actual debridement of tissue, and very commonly are dealt with in the operating room. And a general classification that's commonly used for these include acute wound infections that may be due following a traumatic injury. And these most commonly commonly can be from punches that hit teeth and contaminate the wounds with a variety of pathogens. These are so-called bite-related. And then far greater concern actually to me as a surgeon are post-operative infections, particularly those that occur in the hospital. And I'll be going through some material actually on prevention of surgical site infections, which is right now a very active area in clinical practice and clinical research. We also see more chronic wound infections, and Dr. Joseph will be presenting material on diabetic foot infections. I'll be briefly mentioning stasis ulcers and also pressure sores, which are an important source of mixed flora infections. The next group of infections that we're very deeply concerned about are those that begin as a perianal cellulitis and can then rapidly progress to a necrotizing fasciitis. These infections often require emergency surgery to debride essentially all of the infected tissue and commonly require reoperation. And then we'll also discuss specific syndromes such as Clostridia myonecrosis. So beginning with surgical site infections, these develop somewhere between 2 and 5% of patients in general surveys. There are certain types of procedures, for example, colorectal surgery, where infection rates may actually be as high as 20%. Other procedures such as clean abdominal surgery have infection rates as low as 1% or even less than 1%. There's been a considerable interest in whether or not the incidence of these infections can be reduced. And the Institute of Healthcare Improvement has estimated that approximately half of these infections, surgical site infections, are indeed preventable. So first we'll go through the types of pathogens that we're likely to see. And if you'll notice, most of the organisms and most of the concern is with Staph aureus. And it's important to note and through all of this that we're concerned not only about methicillin-resistant staphylococci, but also methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus. And in most hospitals, including ours in Cincinnati, about half of the postoperative infections are due to methicillin-susceptible staph. The other types of infections, particularly colorectal, as I've mentioned, may be due to mixed flora. More recent studies have actually identified an increasing incidence of Staph aureus, even in these infections, which typically receive both oral antibiotic prophylaxis and then parenteral therapy during the procedure. Recently, there's been a movement that began in the 1990s as the Surgical Quality Improvement Project, which is now morphed into the Surgical Care Improvement Project. That is a government-sponsored program, and the infection module of that program is intended to reduce the incidence of postoperative surgical site infections. The first part of this is the use of prophylactic antibiotics and their administration within 1 hour prior to operation. The infection module number two has to do with appropriate selection of antibiotics that really is driven by the procedure to be performed. The skip infection module number, or the infection module number three, is that they be discontinued within 24 hours of operation, and there's an exemption for cardiac surgery, which allows therapy out to 48 hours. These conclusions are all very heavily evidence-based, where the administration of antibiotics beyond 24 hours Does ADDS no value, and does ADDS some risk to the patient of acquiring resistant organisms and experiencing drug toxicities? The skip module number four has to do with maintaining serum glucose below 200 for cardiac surgery patients and is not generally applied to non-cardiac patients. The other point is appropriate hair removal, which has to do with either not removing hair at all or using a clippers rather than a razor actually just prior to the beginning of the operation. And then finally, there's very good evidence that particularly for colorectal surgery patients who, again, are at high risk of infection, that maintaining normothermia generally meant greater than 36 degrees centigrade greatly decreases the infection rate. And hospitals are now required to report their compliance with these measures. And an important issue that I want to discuss with you is that recently results of very large numbers of patients have been looked at. And what's shown in this slide is a graphic taken from the article whose title you see, which demonstrates that there has been increased compliance with the skip measures through time, but there's been little, if any, change in the infection rates. And there's been other studies that have confirmed these findings. In this particular study, it was observed that patients that met six or more criteria, in other words, six module elements, were completed correctly, that there was a significant reduction in this group, but another similarly powered study did not find this effect. There are several reasons that might explain this, and I think most importantly is the emergence of Staph aureus, both the community-acquired Staph aureus in the United States, but also the spread of Staph aureus in other countries as surgical site pathogens. There's been a great deal of work done looking at the role of nasal carrier status as a risk factor for surgical site infections with Staph aureus. It's become a particularly acute problem for total joint replacement patients and for patients undergoing cardiovascular surgery. This is a very important study in my mind because it demonstrates the benefits of decolonizing patients that are identified preoperatively of carriers. This was a large Dutch study where patients who were screened for Staph aureus and found to be positive were randomized either to decontamination with nasal mupirocin and chlorhexidine skin preparation or no intervention at all. And it's important to note in this study that all of the organisms encountered were methicillin susceptible, and essentially all of the patients received ceftriaxone, which has activity against this organism. And in this graphic, you see the high incidence of infection, particularly late infections, that occurred in the group receiving placebo interventions, and the very highly significant reduction in infection rates in those that were treated with mupirocin. And again, this reduction was seen in the face of appropriate antimicrobial prophylaxis for the surgical procedures. I'm going to change subjects now and discuss severe necrotizing soft tissue infections. These are not very common in clinical practice, especially outside of large trauma centers and/or large referral hospitals, and there are several different names for these syndromes. In general, I prefer the use of the term necrotizing fasciitis, or the most common variety we see, Fournier's gangrene. There really, as far as I'm concerned, are three classifications. One, the most common mixed infection with anaerobic species, with facultative anaerobes and gram-positive organisms. And the important role of streptococci is to be emphasized. These commonly also include, again, gram-negative rods and anaerobes such as Bacteroides. Another syndrome that is seen less frequently is clostridial myonecrosis. And then I would have to point out the incidence and important incidence of group A streptococcal infections, which are caused by toxin-producing streptococci and are commonly seen, for example, after delivery in women. There is a less common syndrome due to a Vibrio that's been seen predominantly from contamination with seawater, and it was really became a very prominent element in caring for survivors of the tsunami in Thailand. So the signs of these infections are important to note because a high index of suspicion is needed for many of these patients. The physical signs include a pain disproportion to the physical findings, bulli that are violaceous, typically from hemorrhage, skin sloughing, anesthesia, very rapid progression in gas in the tissue, either on x-ray or on physical examination. And this graphic depicts an artist's scheme of the infection, which occurs in the subcutaneous fascia, which in fact is fat. And in that area, it's very poorly vascularized with difficulty in delivering antibiotics, white cells, and other host defense elements, and leads to very rapid clotting and thrombosis of blood vessels in this plane that feed the overlying skin. And you very rapidly see, due to toxins and the thrombosis of vessels, formation of a hemorrhagic exudate under the skin and the formation of the bulli, which I think you can appreciate. This is an example of a clostridial infection preoperatively. I think you can see the necrosis into the fascia. This is in the arm. And then this is a Gram stain taken at the time of operation. Diagnosing necrotizing fasciitis is primarily a clinical diagnosis, and once the infection is even suspected, the patients should be very urgently operated upon to determine the extent of the infection and to excise as much as possible. Surgically, these patients are returned to the operating room usually within 24 hours. To ensure that no new necrosis has developed and that the inadequate debridement has been completed. So to conclude this presentation, I'd like to just emphasize a few key points. That skin and skin structure infections remain predominantly a Staph aureus problem. And this again is both methicillin resistant and susceptible staphylococcal species. For surgical site infections, the predominance in the United States of community-acquired MRSA likely, in my mind, explains the fact that very careful adherence to the SCIP protocols have not dramatically lowered infection rates. And this takes us to a new area of trying to decolonize patients, again, particularly those undergoing joint replacement or cardiovascular surgery. Finally, for mixed flora infections, including necrotizing infections, empiric treatment is needed for a broad range of organisms, including gram-negative rods, aerobic and microaerophilic gram-positive cocci, and in appropriate settings, anaerobes. I thank you very much for your attention.
I'm Ron Jones. I'm a clinical microbiologist and a pathologist from Iowa, and I was asked to cover the topic of multi-drug resistance, a significant problem in hospital and community practice. What I chose to do during this presentation is to look at the organisms that are causing the most common types of infections and look at those as having potential emerging resistances and bring you up to date on some of the most serious problems that we have here in the United States, and also put it in the context with how these may be a problem, not only for us, but may even be more serious problems in other parts of the world. The first topic I would like to cover is what are the pathogens causing the most common infections that we see in clinical practice. The first one of those is complicated skin and skin structure infections. And the way to get that information on the frequency of these bacteria is to look at the results that are taken as part of new drug applications to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The most recent trials that have led to the release of a drug are for ceftaroline clinical trials of skin and skin structure infection. As you can see on this slide, the most common pathogens are gram-positives. In fact, they're dominantly found with approximately 80-plus percent of all of the pathogens are gram-positive, dominated by Staph aureus, and many of those are methicillin-resistant strains. Also found, however, are a few gram-negatives, which includes Klebsiella and E. coli among the enteric bacilli, and Pseudomonas aeruginosa, but found in very, very small numbers. So with that as a background, I would like to really focus on what is happening among the Staph aureus population. To address that, I went into the Century Antimicrobial Surveillance Protocol database, and almost 40,000 organisms are shown here. One of the most striking things about the trends of various resistances in Staph aureus is the MRSA rate for the last decade shows a stepwise increase from 40% resistance up to 57% resistance through 2008. And there was a dramatic drop starting in 2009 of the MRSA rate, which is presumed to be due to changing clones of MRSA, as well as interventions at local levels in hospitals that are monitored in these surveillance programs. Concurrent with that is the fluoroquinolone resistance patterns, which have been stepwise moving up, usually at same rates. But what has happened, which looks like clonal changes, the incidence of MRSA that have concurrent fluoroquinolone resistance, instead of getting worse over time, as you can see by the third column, it was usually very high in the first half of the decade and then shifted down almost 20% by the end of the decade. This is very clearly means to us that have been observing that the clones have changed and the emergence of the USA 300 community-acquired MRSA has become the dominant type of infection that we're seeing in our country. It's not only the problems we have with those two antibiotics, you can also see some other evidence with the resistance rates changing over the decade with six other agents that might be used for MRSA infections. Some drugs are hopelessly not usable, like the macrolide antibiotics, erythromycin, which shows a resistance rate of 90% or greater. But again, during the middle of the decade, resistance rates to the fluoroquinolones, as shown here by levofloxacin's resistance rates, and clindamycin resistance rates, something happened. And again, more evidence that what we have seen is clonal shifts toward the USA 300 and the community-acquired MRSA types infections becoming more and more important to therapy for the rest of the decade and into the second decade of the 21st century. So we have a lot of drugs that are not as good as they were, but we have some compounds that are used for MRSA infections and other multi-drug resistant gram-positive infections. One of those agents or classes is linezolid among the oxazolidinones. This is data from another surveillance program that's run by my laboratory, and this looks at the overall rates of oxazolidinone or linezolid resistance from 2004 through 2009 with well over 30,000 organisms. On a yearly basis, we can see that the amount of resistance to the oxazolidinones is really quite small, with the sampling of all of the gram-positive organisms here in six major groups showing the resistance rate is far less than 1%. However, you can look particularly at coagulase-negative staphylococci and the enterococci, and these enterococci particularly will have rates that were over 1% approximately 2 or 3 years ago. And also the ones that are highlighted on this slide, you can see that have rates of more than 1%. But the good news is here, this drug particularly remains particularly usable at approximately a resistance rate, even among the species that are most likely to have resistance at a rate of approximately 1%, an overall susceptibility rate then of approximately 99%. Also, another concern about resistances to MRSA is the resistances emerging to the glycopeptides and related drugs, in other words, vancomycin and daptomycin. what we have found through the years, there's been numerous types of resistance mechanisms to vancomycin, which have been called VISA, which is vancomycin intermediate, Staph aureus, and then there's vancomycin resistant Staph aureus, or VRSA type strains have emerged over that period of time, as well as some what we call heteroresistant, or HVISAs. And you can see there's essentially a linear relationship that once there is a resistance pattern that emerges to vancomycin, daptomycin resistances or less susceptible strains are also are emerging simultaneously. In other words, if we had an organism that had a higher MIC to vancomycin, it is more likely to have among the higher MICs to the daptomycin as well. Another type of antibiotic now that has entered this space as a potential treatment modality is ceftaroline, which is a cephalosporin antimicrobial agent that enjoys having potency against MRSA strains and Staphylococcus aureus in general. This data from 2010 of 2,146 isolates of Staph aureus shows the MIC distribution, which ranges from approximately 0.12 micrograms per ml to a high of 2 micrograms per ml. In fact, there has not been any strain documented for that year in the United States for this antibiotic at greater than 2 micrograms per ml. Recently, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration had applied a breakpoint for that for susceptibility at less than or equal to 1 microgram per ml, with the category of the MICs above that being called non-susceptible because the agency was unable to detect a level of which susceptibility to ceftaroline might be diminished. So even at this point in time, going into 2011 here, what we have is now a new class of drugs which has been previously thought to be useless against MRSA as being one of the best potential treatment modalities in this country. Let's move on to a different type of infection. The infection being, again, another very common one, which is community-acquired bacterial pneumonia. The most common pathogens also coming out of a recent trial for ceftaroline called the FOCUS 1 and 2 trials show that the usual cast of characters or as far as pathogens are concerned are shown here. Those are the pneumococcus or streptococcus pneumoniae, Staph aureus, and Haemophilus influenza are now most often found in these trials. It is particularly of importance to see that Staph aureus is among those pathogens that are considered to be of community origin. Why do we need possibly, new drugs and new drugs being studied in this type of an infection? Well, the data, again, from the Sentry Antimicrobial Surveillance Program, which was published late last year, very clearly shows the reason why. These are among the most common beta-lactam antibiotics that are tested and used clinically, those being amoxicillin clavulanic acid, third-generation cephalosporin called ceftriaxone, and penicillin given at high dose are most often used in these types of clinical scenarios, sometimes in combination with macrolide agents. What this is the resistance rate, again, over the last decade, as you can see, is a remarkable increase in the amount of beta-lactam resistance among the Streptococcus pneumoniae strains. What happened, however, in the year approximately 2000-2001 was the introduction of the vaccine covering 7 different serotypes of the Streptococcus pneumoniae. Immediately after that, there was a change in the serotypes of the pneumococci, and they changed to clones that were less resistant than before the introduction. This profoundly affected the susceptibility rates to the beta-lactam antibiotics, and it was a period of time where there was decreased susceptibility and then starting to increase the resistance again over time. And we can see now going through the year 2009, we have had a steady increase in the amount of resistance to the 3 beta-lactam antibiotics that are listed here. I've also put on the chart that there's now been the recent introduction, in fact, early in 2010, of the new 13-valent vaccine. And we're anxiously awaiting to see, again, how the introduction of that vaccine may affect the resistance rates that we see in Streptococcus pneumoniae. What we do then also at the same time is have an opportunity to see if the new antimicrobial agent, ceftaroline, has a potential use in this type of infection, regardless of the vaccine effects. What you see here is the cumulative percentage of strains of pneumococci from the 2010 surveillance program for this pathogen. 1,200 of these pneumococci were tested against ceftaroline, ceftriaxone, and penicillin. And you can see on the extreme right-hand side of this chart that the overall coverage of ceftaroline at less than or equal to 0.5 microgram per ml is essentially almost absolute. And you can also appreciate that this newer cephalosporin is approximately 16-fold more potent than the previous best cephalosporin used against pneumococci, and that drug it was ceftriaxone. So how good is it? Well, the Food and Drug Administration has assigned a breakpoint like they have for other pathogens, including Staph aureus, which I've told you about earlier. The breakpoint, again, was chosen to encompass the susceptible population of strains that were found in the clinical trial. There was no organisms in the clinical trial with MICs of 0.5 micrograms per ml or less, and the actual wild-type distribution of the MICs for these pneumococci in the United States only includes approximately 1% of the strains at 0.5, with essentially no strains at all over that MIC level. So again, this is a cephalosporin that has great potential use for community-acquired bacterial pneumonia. I'd like to change directions a little bit here and talk about some strains that might be causing types of infections that would be more likely to be found in the hospital environment. As part of a program that was put on by the NIH as well as the Infectious Disease Society of America, I was asked to tabulate what the most common pathogens were that were involved in hospital-acquired bacterial pneumonia as well as ventilator-assisted bacterial pneumonias. What is listed on the left-hand side of the slide are the six most common pathogens that are associated with those types of infections. And as you remember from the previous slides, the types of pathogens that were found in more in the community setting, this is very, very different, with Staph aureus being the most common pathogens, along with a series of various gram-negative pathogens, including Pseudomonas aeruginosa, Enteric bacilli, and Acinetobacter. What I did in that presentation to the agency as well as to the society was look at over time to see what the resistance rates were in the United States that had increased from 2004 to 2006 to 2008. And I've listed those on there here for each one of those pathogens. As an example, for Pseudomonas aeruginosa, if it's found on this, the name of the drug is found on this slide, it has increased resistance to that antibiotic with that pathogen of more than 5%. If it is listed and it is coated with red ink, so to speak, that means there was a change toward greater resistance of 10% or greater. As you can see, in the United States in general, there has been a drift downward from 5 to 10% to numerous antimicrobial families. So we do have this continuing emergence of resistance, and even to some of the most powerful antibiotics we have, including the fluoroquinolones, fourth-generation cephalosporins, carbapenems like meropenem, and the more recently introduced doripenem. As part of those resistances, we're also seeing, particularly among gram-negative pathogens, is a grouping of enzymes that are produced by the Enterobacteriaceae or the Enteric bacilli. So this is another study that's presented here at the ICAC meeting in the fall of 2011, data from our laboratory where we looked at, again, thousands of Enteric bacilli, all of these coming from bacteremias. And we found within that population of bacteria that there was 7% of those organisms were highly resistant to advanced spectrum cephalosporins like cefepime, like ceftazidime, like ceftriaxone. And some of these also carried resistances to the carbapenem antibiotics like imipenem and meropenem. What we did, however, is something that's not been done in recent years, is finding out which enzymes were present. There used to be very few of those. Certainly, it was not more than 7% among all of them across the entire United States in the past. But what we see here is there's a great diversity of various types of genes that are producing these enzymes that destroy this class of drugs, which includes CTXM series, which are the dominant ones, including the CTXM15, which is the most common type of extended spectrum beta-lactamases. And you can see on this chart an enzyme series called KPCs, which are carbapenemases that will destroy the carbapenems, like I said, imipenem or meropenem or doripenem. So this is really getting bad in the United States? Well, I think what we have is obviously emerging problems in our country. But what we have to do is to look on a worldwide stage to see how bad it can be. And I also would like to say what I'm going to show you now in just one or two slides is that, you know, the India scenario is a wake-up call. And you can see how bad it possibly could be. I just showed you a slide that said there were 7% ESBL phenotypes in the United States. Currently in India, depending on which hospital you look at, those rates are 60 to 80% of the strains have enzymes that will destroy the broad-spectrum beta-lactam class of agents, particularly cephalosporins. The carbapenem susceptibility to non-fermentative gram-negative bacilli like Acinetobacters and Pseudomonas aeruginosa, susceptibility of only 30 to 60% depending on the species, and the susceptibility to carbapenems among the enteric bacilli because of these serine carbapenemases and other beta-lactamases, including metallobeta-lactamases, has diminished their activity down to approximately 85 to 95%. In many parts of India, they only have two antibiotics left. A member of the polymyxin families, and in some institutions, they could pair that up with, amikacin and some other drugs. This is not where we want to be, so we have to implement certain types of measures. Recently, in 2008, there was recognized that India had yet another problem. It was eventually molecularly characterized. The gene was identified and was given the name New Delhi metallobeta-lactamase, or NDM1. That MDM type of gene that was found in very common organisms such as E. coli or Klebsiella has enzyme affinity for hydrolyzing or destroying essentially every beta-lactam antibiotic we have. What makes it worse, we've destroyed all those antibiotics, but also it carries genes that will destroy other commonly used classes of drugs, including the aminoglycosides, the chloramphenicols, and et cetera, et cetera. So this is a very, very serious problem. These types of organisms have been carried back to other countries from the Asian subcontinent and have now been found in countries like the United States, Canada, Middle Eastern countries, numerous countries all across Europe and Australia, et cetera. So they're essentially all over the world, and they now can rapidly increase and possibly be carried to the gene to other organisms and making it very difficult. Therapy of these antimicrobials within India or any other country will be very limited, and we'll have to be using, again, the polymyxin classes, glycyclines, phosphomycins, and monobactams. So we definitely have a look at the future for possibly the United States, and we have to do some interventions. In conclusion, we are at a point in the practice of infectious disease and approaching of resistance mechanisms that we have to do something about it and have some recognitions. And the points in this slide are the following, that we have some escalating resistances to all known antimicrobial agents. And it's foolhardy to say that, a drug is going to last for a long time before resistances occur. These genes are highly mobile, and they can go from one organism to another and even cross the ocean through medical tourism. We also have an urgent need to renew our infection control strategy in the United States. It's been let go for entirely too long, because we have to catch them at the local level and to intervene at the local level before it gets passed on from one patient to another, one ward to another, or from hospital to hospital on the hands of healthcare workers and so on. Also, we need improvement in education. This was a process that was brought to our attention actually by the American Society for Microbiology back in 1995. And education is so important at all kinds of levels, and particularly the emphasis on recent antimicrobial stewardship at the local and national level. Also, the public has to have knowledge of these types of problems. But unfortunately, there's been too much sensationalism and not pointed arguments about the education, trying to get not only the public on board, but also to get government on board. And lastly, practicing physicians, nurses, and veterinarians were all part of the game of trying to preserve antimicrobial agents. Finally, combination chemotherapy, because these resistance are so severe and across all classes of antimicrobial agents, combination chemotherapy will become the rule of our practice. And until we get the development of new antimicrobial agents, we will have to continue to use more and more combinations to get the 90 or 95% empiric coverage of these types of organisms that are emerging in our environment. We've got to remind government, and we've got to remind the pharmaceutical companies that we urgently need new antimicrobial agents, and particularly in government, we have to remind the agencies that we have to have a way to qualify combination chemotherapies for treatment and release out into clinical practice. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Warren Joseph. I'm a podiatrist and infectious disease consultant at Roxboro Memorial Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Today I've been asked to talk to you about diabetic foot infections. Now, the burden of diabetic foot infections has been massively underappreciated. According to the CDC, approximately 28 million people in the United States have diabetes. About 15% of those patients will develop a foot complication. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 70,000 lower extremity amputations occur each year as a result of diabetes. And diabetic foot infection is the number one cause of hospital days over all of the other complications of diabetes. So this is a significant problem with mortality and morbidity that needs to be discussed and needs to be understood. I'd like to present one of my cases for you. This was a 61-year-old male who presented to our emergency department. He had a history of present illness of, quote, a few weeks duration of having an ulcer on his foot. He self-treated that ulcer with hydrogen peroxide and did some dressing changes. He told us that he walked about a mile a week ago, and after walking a mile, he noted some increased pain, redness, and swelling. Well, he was admitted to the hospital, and blood work showed a white blood count of 17.3, a glucose of 220, a creatinine of 1.1, a BUN of 14, and his temperature orally was 101.5. X-rays were taken, which showed local soft tissue gas of the medial first metatarsal phalangeal joint, but there was no evidence of osteomyelitis in this X-ray. This is his clinical presentation when I saw him in the emergency department. You can see the massive amount of edema and erythema of the foot. He had two sinuses on the medial aspect of his foot with foul-smelling drainage. This was the primary lesion that he had had for a few weeks on the bottom of his foot, which is the classic malperforans ulceration due to diabetic neuropathy. And this is a view of the dorsal aspect of the foot, where again, you can appreciate the significant erythema and edema of this foot. Well, the question I would then ask you is, how would you classify this diabetic foot infection? Is this an IDSA non-infected, an IDSA mild, moderate, or severe infection? Back in 2004, we published our first set of evidence-based guidelines on the treatment of diabetic foot. They're available on the IDSA's website at idsociety.org. And what we did, one of the things we did with this set of guidelines is come up with an infection severity scoring system. There are a lot of classification systems of various wounds, but none of them were specific for infection. So our goal was to come up with an easy-to-use, easy-to-remember scoring system that specifically looks at how severe the infection is. An IDSA uninfected wound is one where there are no clinical signs of infection. Well, obviously, that's not the case here because this patient clearly does have infection. So that leaves, is this either a mild, a moderate, or a severe? An IDSA moderate infection has greater than or equal to one of the following: cellulitis extending more than 2 centimeters, lymphangitic streaking, spread beneath superficial fascia, deep tissue abscess, or gangrene. But in our moderate infections, the patient is systemically well and metabolically stable. Now, we compare that to the IDSA severe infection. The findings on the foot are going to be exactly the same, that greater than or equal to two of the following, cellulitis extending more than 2 centimeters, etc. Where we differentiate our moderate from our severe is in the moderate, the patient is systemically well and metabolically stable. In the severe, the patient is systemically unwell, metabolically unstable. These are your sick patients. These are your septic patients that are displaying at least some of the signs of systemic inflammatory response syndrome. Now, this IDSA classification has been validated. Larry Lavery, publishing in 2007 in Clinical Infectious Diseases, applied the IDSA classification to over 1,600 diabetic foot wounds. And what he found is as you increase severity from mild through moderate to severe, you have significant increases in rates of hospitalization and amputation. It's very gratifying, having been one of the authors of this system, to see that it is now being used in just about every paper that it's been published in the world literature in diabetic foot in the last 5 or 6 years. Currently in the United States, only 3 antibiotics actually carry an FDA indication for the treatment of diabetic foot infection without concomitant osteomyelitis. They are ertapenem, piperacillin tazobactam, and linezolid. Now this raises a question. These were all approved under the old FDA guidance of uncomplicated versus complicated skin and skin structure. Where does diabetic foot infection fit under the new FDA acute bacterial skin and skin structure infection guidance? And that's something we don't know. So it's possible that these may be the only 3 antibiotics that are ever going to be approved for diabetic foot, which would really be a shame. So I think something has to be done and some guidance has to be developed to allow new antibiotics to achieve this indication. This raises the question about the need for MRSA coverage. Well, of course, this falls into the whole antimicrobial stewardship de-escalation versus escalation discussion. And I'll tell you, my personal practice is we de-escalate most patients. We start them as if they have MRSA coverage, or we start them as if they have MRSA. And if they don't, 72 hours later, the culture results come back, we de-escalate. We take the MRSA coverage out. But with the new draft IDSA diabetic foot guidelines, we've actually decided to use pretest probability of MRSA infection in giving guidance on when to initiate anti-MRSA therapy for diabetic foot infections. What do we mean by this? Well, let's say you have a mild diabetic foot infection. If you have anything less than 50 to 60% MRSA at your local institution, then you probably don't need MRSA coverage. But as we increase through moderate and severe, that threshold lowers. So if you even have a 5 or 10% chance of having MRSA in your hospital when the patient has a severe infection, we give the opinion that you probably should start coverage. Bottom line is, we just can't afford to be wrong. And with bone, wait till the biopsy is confirmed. If you've got biopsy-confirmed MRSA, then you do need to treat for MRSA. Another misconception that's out there about diabetic foot is this constant need to treat Pseudomonas. Well, actually, we probably don't need to treat Pseudomonas in many, many of our diabetic foot infections. Let me show you some of the literature that supports that position. There are a number of studies out that looked at clinical response rates in patients with diabetic foot who grew MRSA. Graham, in the piperacillin tazobactam versus ertapenem pivotal trial, on which ertapenem received its complicated skin and skin structure indication, found that in patients who grew Pseudomonas, they had a positive clinical response 70% of the time on ertapenem, but only 60% of the time on piperacillin tazobactam, an antibiotic that actually has inherent anti-pseudomonal coverage. Lipsky, publishing the SIDESTEP study, the largest study ever on moderate to severe diabetic foot infections, found very similar results. In patients who grew Pseudomonas, they had a positive clinical response 76.9% of the time on ertapenem, an antibiotic with no inherent anti-pseudomonal coverage, but only 70% in piperacillin tazobactam. Now, I'm in no way implying that ertapenem is a better anti-pseudomonal drug than piperacillin tazobactam. What I'm saying is the Pseudomonas doesn't matter. It's a colonizer. It's a contaminant. More recently, in the CANVAS 1 and 2 trials published on ceftaroline, what they found is, even though ceftaroline has no inherent anti-pseudomonal activity, 80% of patients who grew Pseudomonas had a positive clinical response. And this actually leads to this conclusion that Nannini published, and I think it's worth reading the quote to you. The demonstration of efficacy in patients with Pseudomonas aeruginosa receiving ceftaroline, a pathogen against which ceftaroline has little activity, most probably reflects the presumptive role of Pseudomonas aeruginosa as a colonizer rather than a true pathogen in many of these infections. So I really can't emphasize that more. The only time I'm considering covering Pseudomonas in a diabetic foot infection is if I grow Pseudomonas from a good, deep, reliable surgical culture. To date, there's only really been one study that's looked at the role of Pseudomonas in these cases and suggested maybe Pseudomonas should be covered, and that's Ben Lipsky's work. What they found was independent risk factors for increased mortality rates, length of stay, and costs included, wound cultures with Pseudomonas. So possibly, if there's a wound culture with Pseudomonas, there is higher mortality, length of stay, and cost. But in speaking to Dr. Lipsky about this, they didn't really stratify this specifically. So it's very difficult to know what this means. And even given that finding, the rates of Pseudomonas were relatively rare, 1.4% in monomicrobial infections and only 8.4% in polymicrobial infections. In other words, Pseudomonas, even when you're looking for it, is relatively difficult to find, and its importance is questionable. So let's just get back to the case to finish up. This is after the first incision and drainage. There's still significant erythema and edema. And you can see I had the surgeon go back and do a further debridement. The wound now looks good. You can see here the erythema and edema is gone from the dorsum of the foot. CNS results showed methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus, group B beta hemolytic strep, Proteus mirabilis. So the patient was discharged to a SNF on cefazolin for 2 weeks, then discharged from the SNF on cefalexin and followed outpatient in our hospital's wound center. And after 3 weeks, I happened to be walking by the wound center and the patient was sitting there, and this was the outcome. So you can save these limbs with concerted efforts. It's a team approach. We need infectious disease. We need surgery, either podiatric surgery, vascular surgery, general surgery, and we need medicine. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Vance Fowler. I'm here today to talk about an important topic in infectious diseases, and that's skin and soft tissue infection. Specifically, I'd like to talk about choosing the correct antibiotic for broad-spectrum coverage. Not every patient needs broad-spectrum antibiotic coverage for skin and soft tissue infection, but I'm going to address the options that are available when they do. My disclosures are previously listed and available for your review. I have four goals that I'd like to achieve in this talk. First, over-treatment of skin and soft tissue infections with antibiotics is the norm, both in the breadth and the duration of therapy. Secondly, interventions can effectively reduce antibiotic use for uncomplicated skin and soft tissue infection. Third, complicated skin and soft tissue infected patients need broad-spectrum antibiotics. And finally, multiple options exist for the broad-spectrum SSTI therapy that these patients require. So, an important point is that most soft tissue infections are actually uncomplicated. This in a recent study by Jenkins et al., published in Clinical Infectious Diseases about a year ago, fully half of the patients they identified had either a cutaneous abscess, here illustrated in red, or uncomplicated cellulitis, illustrated in the green bar. And as you can see, these patients with uncomplicated soft tissue infections comprised half of the overall cohort. Despite the fact that these individuals had uncomplicated soft tissue infection, which is almost exclusively caused by gram-positive pathogens, the majority of them were treated with broad-spectrum antibiotics. So the point of this slide illustrates that the three categories illustrated on the bottom of the slides, cellulitis, abscess, and complicated STIs, were pretty indistinguishable in terms of the antibiotics they were prescribed. So broad overuse of antibiotics for uncomplicated skin and soft tissue infections. So this leads to an obvious question. Could we, as stewards of the antibiotics, better improve patient care and our conservation of antibiotics by guiding antibiotic therapy according to the STI categories? So for example, if those patients with uncomplicated gram-positive skin and soft tissue processes be treated with relatively targeted gram-positive coverage, while those individuals who require broad-spectrum antibiotic coverage would receive the more extended antibiotic therapy that they require until the cultures return. To address this important question, a recent study, again by Jenkins and colleagues, made an important contribution. This study was published in June in the Archives of Internal Medicine. And in essence, they looked at a pre- and post-intervention comparison of uncomplicated soft tissue infection management. They looked at roughly similar numbers of patients, roughly 170 patients in each group, before and after an introduction of a treatment guidelines guidance that they provided to their treating colleagues at the institution. The results of this important study are illustrated here. As you can see in the green bars, the use of inappropriately broad spectrum antibiotics decreased significantly in all categories when compared to the interval before the intervention was employed. Most importantly, this improved antibiotic stewardship was achieved with no loss of clinical efficacy. So the idea of doing the same with less in terms of targeted antibiotics that are selected in a rigorous and evidence-based manner can provide better care. But the question is, what do we do about complicated soft tissue infection? Fully half of these patients in the Jenkins trials had complicated disease. And in those patients, there's clearly a time and a place for broad spectrum coverage. In general, broad spectrum coverage is indicated in two circumstances. First, when you don't know what you're treating and you don't have time to wait until you get the answers. And secondly, when you may be treating more than one organism. Now, the recent changes in epidemiology of this process have further complicated it, with reports of multidrug-resistant pathogens such as community-associated MRSA causing necrotizing fasciitis. In the particular case that's illustrated on this slide, the patient ended up having a histopathologically confirmed case of necrotizing fasciitis due to serratia, highly atypical presentation. So the point of this slide is that complicated STI requires broad-spectrum therapy. One of the useful contributions of the Jenkins study was a beginning effort to try to define just who requires broad-spectrum antibiotics. In this slide that's illustrated here, the investigators defined complicated STI using a variety of characteristics, both clinical and epidemiologic, that would assist in determining who needs targeted gram-positive therapy and who needs broader coverage. Now, the good news is broad-spectrum coverage comes in a lot of flavors. Generally speaking, it can be achieved with two basic approaches. Combination therapy, in which you essentially take one agent from the column of antibiotic choices on the left-hand side and add it to MRSA coverage with one of the drugs on the right-hand side of the columns. And there are a variety of different approaches to achieve this objective. A number of new antibiotics also provide broad-spectrum coverage in a monotherapy option, and these include tigecycline and, most recently, ceftaroline. So this is a busy slide, and the point of this slide is simply to underscore the fact that there are new treatment alternatives on the horizon. This is a list of investigational products, and I'm going to focus in on a few particularly attractive aspects of these various drugs. First of all, terazolid. This is sort of a second-generation linazolid with some important properties. First of all, it retains utility in linazolid-resistant isolates, and secondly, it's only once a day, so a really attractive oral option for future treatment. Secondly, deflloxacin has anti-MRSA coverage in the convenience and familiarity of a fluoroquinolone. And our next particularly interesting characteristic, dalbavancin, has the really interesting prospect of treating ABSSSI with two single doses of antibiotics, one on day zero and one on day seven. Phase three trials are currently underway to address the efficacy in this exciting development. And finally, eridivancin is conducting phase three trials in which the treatment consists only of a single infusion of eridivancin with an extended half-life. So lots of interesting things to keep an eye on in the future. Okay, so in summary, I've tried to make four basic points in this brief overview. First of all, over-treatment of skin and skin structure infections is the norm. Data suggests that over a half of patients with uncomplicated skin and skin structure infections are treated with broad-spectrum antibiotics. Secondly, interventions to reduce this injudicious use of antibiotics appear to work, and it's going to be exciting to see future developments in addressing this problem. Third, complicated skin and skin structure infection patients exist. Not only do they exist, they're common. And these patients do, in fact, need broad-spectrum antibiotics, either until we know what we're treating or when we're actually treating more than one organism. The good news is that for these patients with complicated skin and skin structure infections, multiple options exist for broad-spectrum skin and skin structure infection therapy. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, The Next Generation of Cephalosporins, New Additions in the Arsenal Against CSSSIs. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.